Welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Apologies for my rough-sounding voice. I've got a bit of a cold. And apologies, too, if this show sounds a little rough, aside from my voice. It was resected and sutured from a two-hour fundraising special on WBAI, where the show originates, and then padded with some injectable filler. My guests in the show are Charlie Komenoff, the energy and transportation economist, who's developed a scheme along with the ruling class lawyer Theodore Keel to make New York City buses free and the subways nearly free. Apologies for the New York-centric content, but that's where I've lived for almost 30 years, and the core of the proposal could be adapted to just about any large metropolitan area. And then at the half-hour mark, an interview with the Greek economist Yanis Varoufakis, who will shed some light on the political and economic background to the extraordinary week of rioting in his country. Okay, now let's switch over to some material from the original show. The economic news continues to look very ugly, even uglier since I think my car was stolen this morning. This morning, just before I got ensnared in the case of the missing 1989 Buick, the Labor Department reported that 583,000 people filed first-time claims for unemployment last week, up 58,000 from the previous week. Both the level of initial claims and their movement over the last year are at recession levels, and that's a very big increase in just a week. Initial claims are not yet at the levels of the mid-1970s and early 1980s recessions, but they're heading in that direction. A leading index of employment published by the Conference Board and released earlier this week deteriorated further on the month, suggesting that at least six more months of bad news are in store for the job market. We probably have to see some serious improvement in these two measures, initial claims and the Conference Board's employment indicator, before we can even begin thinking about the economy finding a bottom, much less starting to recover. The housing sector also tends to lead broader economic trends, although it's usually further ahead when things are turning down than when we're turning up. In any case, there's not much sign of stabilization there either. Energetic optimists are drawing some hope from little upticks here and there, but these look like very thin reeds to lean on. And the new forecast posted to economist James Hamilton's EconoBrowser website offers a very gloomy view of the next couple of years. It comes from Michael Duker, formerly of the St. Louis Federal Reserve, now of Russell Investments, who uses a high-tech statistical technique called vector autoregression to predict economic developments. What gives Duker some standing is that he correctly forecasts both the 2001 and 2007 recessions ahead of time, when many other analysts were singing happy songs and nothing else. Of course, as they say in the mutual fund ads, past performance is no guarantee of future results, but here we go anyway. Duker sees the recession not bottoming until July or August of next year. And he also sees the job market continuing to shrink for close to a year longer than that. He projects that we have another 4 or 5 million jobs to lose on top of the nearly 2 million we've lost since the peak in employment a year ago. If Duker is right, this is likely to be the longest and most damaging recession since the 1930s. Since the leading indicators are suggesting no turnaround in sight, meaning in the next 3 to 6 months, Duker may well be right about duration. And if the economy has technically bottomed, but jobs are continuing to disappear as he forecasts, that's a recovery in name only. Bottom line, the economy stinks and is likely to get stinkier for some time. Now, there's a chance that if the new Congress and the administration enact a big, quick-acting stimulus program, they're talking about getting $150 billion in infrastructure spending going at the state level, using federal money, in the early months of next year, well, that might mitigate the glum forecast. We shall see. Speaking of the new administration, their novelty and freshness continues to disappoint. I just came across this quote from the uber-wise man Larry Summers in the book Creative Capitalism, a new collection of interviews with movers and shakers conducted by Michael Kinsley. Here's Larry, who's allegedly been reborn after spending so many years as an insufferably arrogant and orthodox prince of the dismal science. Quote, "As for Milton Friedman, I'm not sure he looks so bad. What is most screwed up today? GSEs, that is government-sponsored enterprises like Fannie Mae, Citibank, regional banks. What is the most regulated? Same list. What is the least screwed up? Hedge funds and the like. What is the least regulated? This is what Larry is saying. Hedge funds and the like, he should have said, but this is the way he put it. If regulation means the jihad against short selling that the Securities and Exchange Commission is engaged in, then God help us all. That's the end of the quote from Larry Summers. There's so much that's wrong with this. The government-sponsored enterprises like Fannie Mae and Citibank were supposed to be regulated, but they weren't. Citibank was encouraged in its recklessness by Summers' colleague and mentor Robert Rubin. The hedge funds are deeply screwed up. They're going bust in large numbers and losing piles of money. So if Summers is arguing against regulation, to quote him against himself, then God help us all. But maybe he gave this interview a year ago before his alleged ideological rebirth. We shall see. Finally, a few words about the sit-in at Republic Doors and Windows in Chicago. As you've no doubt heard, the company decided to close the plant without any warning to its workers and was refusing to pay the money that they owed them. The company blamed its bank, the Bank of America, for having cut them off. The workers occupied the factory, and they've won. No, they're not getting their jobs back, and no, they're not going to take over the factory, but they are getting the money that was owed to them. There are many interesting things about this incident. Let me list a few. One, the workers didn't passively accept being screwed, as so many American workers have over the last few decades. A reason for this might be that they were represented by an independent, principled, and democratic, small d, union, the United Electrical Workers, or UE. UE was once a pretty radical union, but it was hammered during the McCarthy era. Though a relative weakening now, this incident does suggest that a good union can make a big difference, at least in the militancy and enlightenment of workers. Two, one of the reasons that the case attracted so much attention is that the Bank of America has gotten $25 billion in public bailout funds, which they're supposed to use to keep the economy going. Instead, they were hoarding the money and calling in loans. This produced a very bad PR for the bank and is no doubt one of the reasons they relented. But it's interesting that this public bailout now provides some degree of public leverage over the behavior of financial institutions. And three, maybe this is just the beginning of a fight-back movement in this politically demobilized country. Yeah, the United Auto Workers, an ossified union if there ever was one, isn't giving much sign of resisting their likely evisceration, an evisceration that seems to be part of the so-called industry bailout. But maybe there's hope for other American workers as the recession gathers steam. As the old slogan says, don't tread on me. And that was Don't Tread on Me by the Cro-Mags. Yeah, I know the politics of that can be a little questionable. Militant individualism can easily turn reactionary, but it sure sounds good. And now allow me to introduce my introduction to Charlie Komenoff. And now we're joined in the studio by Charles Komenoff, energy and transportation economist, and no friend of the automobile, let's just put it that way. Welcome, Charlie.
Hey, Doug.
So, you've got a scheme to help us avoid big transit fare increase, big service cuts. What's the idea?
Well, the idea is to revolutionize transportation in New York City, and it's an idea that Theodore Keel, the famed labor lawyer and mediator and civic advocate, has had in mind back as far back as the 50s and 60s, and we've kind of fleshed it out over the past year or so. And with the yawning gap that the Ravitch Commission was supposed to fill, the state commission headed by Richard Ravitch that was supposed to come up with some terrific way to plug the MTA deficit and instead has laid an egg, it was released about a week ago, we think that there's a real opportunity to push this plan and have everybody in the city, left, right, and center, all across the political spectrum, embrace this new idea.
All right, so give us the broad outlines of what the scheme is.
Well, there's really three elements. There's variable pricing of cars and trucks driven into the heart of the city, the so-called Manhattan Central Business District, or CBD. There's variable pricing on the subways, but with all subway fares either zeroed out or discounted, but retaining a price to use the subways lower than today's price during the rush hour so that demand is spread out. So we have subways that will be 75% cheaper on average than today's and less crowded during rush hour. And by the way, the city buses will also be free all the time. And third, a big surcharge on taxi cab use, medallion taxi cab use, throughout the city, but that is mostly going to hit Manhattanites. It will hit mostly affluent Manhattanites who use taxis the most, and that's basically to prevent rampant taxi use from taking over and exploiting the newly minted street capacity that will in effect be created because car travel into the heart of the city will be discouraged by the cordon fee. And what we have at the end of the day is $1 billion a year in net revenue. We increase the price to drive, but we slash the price to use mass transit. We end up with a net of $1 billion a year that will repair most of the MTA deficit. We have much speeded streets within the heart of the city so that trucks and taxis and cars can go one-third faster during the daytime in the heart of Manhattan than they do today. We have much better bus service because buses will not only be able to drive faster in the less crowded streets, there will be no human gridlock at the front of the bus with people fumbling for fare cards because the buses will be free. And most importantly, the subways, again, will be 75% cheaper on average. So we're going to turn the transportation system in the city upside down for the benefit of the vast majority of New Yorkers.
The fare collections pay an unusually large portion of the operating costs
of New York City Transit, not compared
to other transit systems.
I'm sorry. I thought you meant the fare collection machinery.
Riders in New York pay a larger portion of the cost of transit than they do in most other cities, right?
Right, and we're gonna scale that back because we're finding this new revenue source, which is people driving into the congested heart of the city.
So that's just a prelude to saying sacrificing much of that fare revenue. How much is given up on the fare side and how much do you collect on the other side?
We're giving up $2.2 billion that's now being collected every year from bus riders and strap hangers. We are adding $2.4 billion in auto tolls to drive into the heart of the city. We're also going to have a modest 25% increase in tolls on the MTA bridges and tunnels that don't funnel into the heart of the city, like, say, the Throgs Neck Bridge or the Whitestone Bridge. That'll raise $200 million. The taxi surcharge is going to raise $700 million. That's a big chunk of change. So, again, at the end of the day, we end up $1 billion ahead, which is revenue that the MTA needs because the stock transfer tax is raising less money, the property sales tax is raising less money, et cetera.
And what about the East River bridges? Any tolls on those?
Oh, yeah. I mean, every way of driving into the heart of the city is going to be tolled. The Hudson River tolls will get this new toll. There will be no offset of existing tolls, by the way, so that's a key difference from the Bloomberg plan that failed earlier this year. Driving into the center of Manhattan from north of 60th Street is going to be tolled, and driving across the East River bridges will also be tolled. These will be tolls without toll booths, so they'll be fast. But most important, it will be equitable because there will be no balancing this on the backs of just people from Brooklyn and Queens. Every driver into the heart of the city will pay, but there will be sharp discounts, steep discounts for driving in when it's least crowded, and at the same time a premium for driving in when it's most crowded and congestion imposes or the use of cars imposes the largest cost on the public.
And how are the tolls to be collected? You say no booths?
No booths. Just Easy Pass, and if you don't have it, then your license plate will be photo red, and you'll either pay rather quickly, using basically the London system, and if you don't pay, then you'll pay more later on.
Now, the London system raises some civil liberties concerns, privacy concerns. What do you say to that?
Anybody walking in the city is not going to be impinged on for this. Anybody riding a bike is not going to be impinged on. Some privacy concerns were long ago sacrificed when drivers and motorists came into existence and decided to surround themselves by 1 ton or 2 tons or 3 tons of steel. And the sacrifice, if there is going to be any incremental sacrifice of privacy, seems like a small price to pay to create a city that's more efficient, equitable, and sustainable.
Now, of course, I can hear the bellowing of suburban populace who will talk about how regressive this is and how unfair this is, and this is just an elitist scheme. And you know, I'm sure you remember what people said during the congestion pricing debate. So how do you respond to all that?
The Bloomberg plan for congestion pricing, a year ago, died for many reasons. But probably the most important is that the plan seemed to take away something from the public. It was going to toll streets or bridges that had been free, you know, for 100 years or more. And what did the Bloomberg plan really promise? A very small improvement in traffic speeds, a modest new chunk of change for the MTA. It was a game changer negatively, but it wasn't a game changer positively. Our plan, the Keel plan, and again, that's Ted Keel's plan, is a game changer by making the public transportation system virtually free, by making it run much better than it ever has, and also speeding up traffic into and inside the heart of the city. So it's transformationally positive, and what we're looking for is a groundswell of support from just about everybody in the city that will push this plan over the top.
What do we know about the demographics of people who ride mass transit versus people who drive?
Well, the people who one thing to be kept in mind is that the vast majority of driving in the city doesn't go into the central business district, and that's going to be unaffected by this plan. And in fact, driving outside the CBD is going to be a little bit easier because there will be less traffic funneling in, say, from Sheepshead Bay and up the spine of Brooklyn and then through downtown Brooklyn and into the city. So if you drive in Brooklyn and don't go into the heart of Manhattan, you're going to be somewhat better off. But what the data show is that people who drive into Manhattan regularly as auto commuters into the heart of the city earn about 40% more on average than their neighbor who either drives somewhere else or works in the heart of Manhattan but takes public transit to get there.
So it's a more affluent population than people who take the subway.
Right. It's people who can better afford it. But even more important than that is that we found that the average car or the average car trip into the heart of Manhattan imposes $30 worth of time loss costs on everybody else who's trying to use the streets and roads and tunnels and bridges. So it certainly is equitable to impose a toll of up to $30, which is more than what we seek to impose in our plan. So all we're doing is balancing the equities. We're internalizing some of the costs of using private automobiles, and in that way creating a more humane and more efficient city.
Now let's linger on that point a bit, because people who drive cars think that they're just free individuals, but they create cost for other people. So could you enumerate how you came up with that $30 cost?
Well, there are two ways to think about it. One is that, all right, let's say you decide to drive the car into the city, on that particular day, and you go from your street onto an arterial, and you slow the traffic behind you. A few cars get slowed by maybe 10 or 15 seconds because you've had to merge in, and that continues every minute that you're on the road, and then you've got to squeeze onto, say, the Prospect Expressway or the BQE or the Brooklyn or the Manhattan or the Williamsburg Bridge, and you're causing a little bit of delay in 5, 10, 20. It ripples back to as many as several dozen cars behind you until that ripple kind of works its way through the system. And if you were to add up the delay to all those vehicles behind yours and multiply by the number of vehicles, you would get a cost that would work out to $30. On average. Now, we didn't model it that way. What we did instead in our spreadsheet, and it's a spreadsheet that's available on the web for anybody who wants to verify it for themselves, is we simply inputted 1,000 more cars a day driving into Manhattan, and we compared the congestion costs with those 1,000 cars to the cost without, and worked out the difference, divided by 1,000 cars, and it works out to about $30 of congestion costs per vehicle.
And this is just time. You're not talking about ecological costs.
Yeah, the ecological costs are about another $10. The noise pollution, the air pollution, the climate pollution, the crash risk, you know, running over and injuring people, or the statistical, the actuarial possibility of doing that. That's another $10. We're not even counting that. The time costs, in fact, dominate, and that's what really moves things in most conversations, so that's why we emphasize it.
I'm speaking with Charlie Komenoff, the energy economist and transportation economist, about how to make the city a more livable place and cut transit fares very, very deeply. Are there any other models for this? Have other cities done similar things?
There are models for bits and pieces of this, but this is a radical plan. But, you know, it's radical. It's not from the left and it's not from the right. I'd almost call it the radical center. It's kind of a revolt from the center. We are hoping to appeal to people on the right who look at the establishment plan, the Dick Ravitch plan, and recoil in horror, because the Ravitch plan is based on a payroll tax that's going to tax this region's economy at the rate of $1.5 billion a year, at the very moment when we are hemorrhaging jobs, when we are losing economic activity, and what we ought to be doing is holding the line on business taxes and taxes on work in order to encourage employment and encourage economic activity. So we want to appeal to the right. We also want to appeal to the left, because this will benefit people on the bottom even more than it will benefit people on the top.
What do we know about the demographics of subway and bus riders?
Bus riders tend to be relatively less affluent, especially outside of Manhattan. And one of the big selling points of our plan is that the buses will be free throughout the city, 24/7, 365 days a year. So this will benefit, you know, bus riders in Tremont Park in the Bronx, in Jackson Heights in Queens, throughout Staten Island, everywhere in the city, which is, you know, where bus traffic is concentrated. It's not, buses are not a Manhattan based mode of travel. It's mostly in the boroughs. The subways are used by a vast spectrum of people, from affluent to non-affluent, but making the subways virtually free, which we will be doing, will certainly be a way to improve mobility for people who are at the bottom of the economic pile.
And I imagine this would have very favorable effects for pedestrians and bicycle riders.
Yes, and we forecast almost a doubling in bicycling usage from this plan as a result of the reduction in auto traffic, which will make cycling and walking not only safer, but just a less stressful experience, because there'll be less noise and less, kind of road contact and less presence of motor vehicles when you're trying to ride a bike or walk on a sidewalk or cross the street.
There's also quite a bit of carnage for pedestrians and bicycle riders as a result of being hit by vehicles.
Yeah, I mean, in every indicator, Doug, this is a plan that's going to make life better in the city. But what we might want to talk about, if we have any more time, is the battle that we hope is going to be shaping up between our plan, the Ted Keel plan, and the Ravitch plan, which is being backed not only by the political establishment, but interestingly enough, by the green group, the environmental establishment.
Yeah, you anticipated my next question, which is the politics of this. Do you have any people in Albany or in city council willing to go to bat for this?
We have a few at the city council, a few in the state legislature, a couple of business and labor groups, who've basically indicated that as there begins to be some more public talk about this plan, which we only released yesterday, actually, it's brand new, that they will come out and express support. And rather than give names, I'll tell you and our listeners that next Tuesday, the 16th, the City Council Transportation Committee is having a hearing at City Hall at 10 in the morning. We're going to be there presenting our plan, and it's at that time that we hope to be able to have a show of support in front of City Hall. But the thing that your listeners can do, and my fellow WBAI subscribers can do, is talk to your civic groups. Talk to your Working Families Party, which is just straddling the fence on this and not taking a position. Talk to some of your transportation reform groups and your environmental groups. many of which are lining up with the Ravitch plan. I'm happy to say that Transportation Alternatives, a group that I worked with 10 and 20 years ago, is an exception, and they are supporting our plan, the Keel plan. But talk to them and get them to reconsider and to express support for this plan to turn transportation upside down in the city in a way that's going to really revolutionize our city.
I imagine you talked to some of the establishment green groups about this and they were not interested?
I've talked to one. I'd rather not give names because, Doug, this is all so new, and we've been crunching the numbers, getting the spreadsheet to work, rolling out the plan. So a lot of conversations that we wanted to have, we haven't been able to have yet. And we hope to have those conversations soon. But it is disturbing, the tendency that I'm seeing so far for transportation reform groups and green groups that are understandably concerned about being able to fund the subways and buses, about lining up with a Ravitch plan that just promises more of the same, and that by keeping transit and road or auto traffic separate, by trying to address public transportation on the one hand and road and highway congestion on the other hand, is simply going to perpetuate the dysfunctional congestion and the underfunded, underperforming transit that we've had in our city for the past 100 years. And what Ted Keel's plan does is bring those two together in a way that can solve the problems of both. And so we hope to be out there selling our allies, or who ought to be our allies, in the green groups and the transportation community, that the Ted Keel plan is a plan for the city's present and for the city's future.
Any thoughts on why there's not more enthusiasm come from those quarters?
I think our plan, well, two reasons. One is, again, our plan is brand new. You know, it's just been out on the blogs for about 28 hours. And, you know, it's kind of hard to do the sell and seal the deal just in a day or two. It's going to take more time. But I think, you know, second, there's just a kind of defeatism. You know, you and I have talked about this before, especially in the big green groups that are, they're willing to settle, you know, they settle for cap and trade instead of a carbon tax. They settle for, you know, modest incremental reductions in pollution instead of for game-changing ones. You know, they bargain over, you know, little bits of wind and solar photovoltaics instead of rolling out really revolutionary plans to put renewable energy out in the forefront. They've just gotten used to tinkering with the system, and when they see something that goes to the heart of the system and turns it inside out, I think that they don't really know how to deal with that.
And finally, since you did mention the carbon tax and you have to leave in a couple of minutes, what you are one of the people behind a carbon tax website. Any news on what the incoming administration might do?
No, you know, no bombshells. You know, I think what we can say is that you know, if the administration is going to move away from cap and trade, which is an invitation to market manipulation and more financial disasters following in the sorry footsteps of the meltdown that we're still, you know, in the midst of in the financial sector, they're going to do so only if they're pushed from the bottom. And again, it means that green groups need to break their allegiance to cap and trade, you know, which may have had some basis 10 or 12 years ago, but at this point in time seems nonsensical. We had a briefing on Capitol Hill just the day before yesterday, where the newly elected chair of the Democratic caucus in the House, John Larson, representative from Hartford, Connecticut, spoke passionately and committedly in favor of a carbon tax, and there need to be more like Representative Larson, and it's just going to take a lot of organizing to get us there.
All right, and then before I let you go,
can I just give the website for the Keel plan?
Please do. Yes.
It's keelplan.org, and Keel is K-H-E-E-L plan, one word, nine letters, keelplan.org.
All right, and I know you have to go pick up your son. So thanks for joining us. I've been speaking with Charlie Komenoff, energy economist, transportation economist, and that website again, Keel plan, K-H-E-E-L plan.org. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web at kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program Behind the News. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about Greece. And that was some of the minuet from Beethoven's Septet, Opus 20, performed by an unnamed ensemble of seven Hungarians whose individual names mean nothing to me, and probably to you as well. But it's a lovely performance on Naxos. Extraordinary riots in Greece over the last week, with mostly young crowds filling the streets of Athens and other cities wreaking havoc. What's it all about? Here's an analysis from Yannis Varoufakis, a professor of economics at the University of Athens. Your country is exploding, and obviously the death of the youth is what set things off, but what is behind this, all the rioting in the streets?
As always with such explosions, social explosions, there isn't just one cause. But if we have to pin it down, I'd say that since the mid-1990s, Greek society has undergone a major modernization drive, let's say. And that drive had some real effect in terms of increasing GDP, gross national product, let's say. It raised a lot of expectations. And then, let's say in the last 3 or 4 years, these expectations were not fulfilled for the vast majority of the population. With the onslaught of the financial crisis, some serious financial scandals involving the government, and an authoritarian turn of the police, the circumstances were ripe for the explosion, the social explosion that you mentioned, and all that it took was a spark of the killing of a 15-year-old schoolboy. And suddenly we have the riots that we have on the streets, in the streets of Athens, but not just Athens, almost the whole of the country.
Who is participating in the street activities? Is it mostly young people or is it broader than that?
I think that the vast majority are youngsters. They are 15 to 18-year-olds. Those are the people who are sort of confronting the police forces. Now, yesterday, on Wednesday, there was a national strike called by the trade unions. Mind you, that strike had been called weeks in advance. It was already, it had already been planned for yesterday. And what happened was that there was an interesting convergence, a kind of coalescence between the trade union, the older stalwarts of the trade, of the labor movement, and the 15-year-olds who suddenly merged on the streets. The demonstration passed off quite nicely while the older people were on the streets. They are quite good at safeguarding their marches. But then when they disappeared, when they went home, further riots started between the youngsters and the police.
And how have the police been reacting to the riots?
Clumsily, brutally, incompetently. They will attack quite often bypassers, usually young people who have nothing to do with riots. They will leave the rioters and the looters alone. If the police wanted to design an intervention that would have the least effect in terms of law and order and the greatest effect in terms of culminating hatred towards them, they could not have done a better job than what they have done.
Now, I read in the New York Times this morning that the government's reaction has been rather tolerant. Is that misinformation?
I would say so. Things are not as, you know, just sort of black and white as they seem. Let me give you a very brief example which conveys the situation, I think, quite well. All right. Compare and contrast the following two situations, both of which I was a witness to. You're sitting in a cafe with sort of older intellectuals, pseudo-intellectuals like myself, in the city center, just chatting and having coffee. Suddenly, riot police come in. They beat people up without asking any questions, without doing any searches, without any provocation whatsoever, and then they leave. Okay, that's episode number one. Episode number two, a house was burgled the other day. I called the police, and they never came. They never turned up. So there is this combination of brutality with no explanation, with no reason, and then either towards criminals or to rioters, complete and utter tolerance. So what do you make of that?
Of course, now a generation ago, Greece was run by a military regime. Are there memories being excited of that period?
Well, they have never gone away. Even amongst the youth of today, the 15 and the 16-year-olds who were not born back then, the experience of not just one dictatorship in the 1967 to 1974 period, but a prolonged, slow-burning authoritarian regime from the mid-1930s to the mid-1970s. It has left it an indelible mark on most people, including the youngsters.
Let's talk about the broader Greek economy. You talked about a little bit about this earlier. I assume that Greece has gone through the kind of neoliberalization that many other countries around the world have gone through in the last decade or two.
That's absolutely right. And by popular consent, in the early 1990s, speaking from a microeconomic point of view, Greece was a basket case. You know, we had 17, 18, 20% inflation. The Greek currency, the drachma, as it was then, was sort of, you know, in a state of permanent crisis. Productivity was incredibly low, and living standards were falling behind. The socialist government, social democratic government of the mid-1990s, decided to simply, you know, adopt the neoliberal policies of the European Union. They did a pretty good job of it, in the sense that they managed to reduce inflation down to 3% from a high of 20%, and to have Greece, against all odds, accepted in the Eurozone. At the same time, a remarkable period of growth ensued from 1994 up until last year, let's say, of more than 4% a year, which is not, by Chinese standards, is not great, but by European standards, it was pretty good. And you could see that there was wealth being accumulated. Mind you, the distribution of this wealth was particularly skewed. And moreover, I think that what has added to the sense of injustice amongst the youth of Greece today is that the ruling class, let's put it simply, the rich, are cordoning their own children off. They have their own private schools in which they're taught an international baccalaureate curriculum intended for their offspring to go overseas, abroad, United States, United Kingdom, and so on and so forth, where to study. And they have separated them, sort of segregated them from the public education system of Greece, which means that Greece has become a country in which the ruling class, the elites, have no stake in the education system. And yet, at the same time, the Greek educational system keeps churning out a very large proportion of well-educated youngsters who are condemned to dead-end jobs, if they can get one, paying something like, in American dollars, something like $900,000 a month, in a country where a cappuccino costs $5. Therefore, this, to some extent, at least, explains the frustration that those hordes of quite well-educated youngsters feel.
What was the source of the growth? Where did that 4%, what sectors were driving the 4% growth?
Well, first it was public investment in infrastructure. Greece has truly undergone a major transformation in terms of infrastructure. You can tell if you've ever been to Greece, if you had ever been to Greece in the 1990s and you come now, you'll see new roads, new airplanes, metro systems, and so on and so forth. But it wasn't just that. It was the private sector too. Greece became a mini miracle state in the Balkans. It became, if you want, the only European economy in the Balkan Peninsula, and its corporations became quite significant players in the region. But I think the most important component of this growth is migration. Greece went from a situation when I was growing up in the 70s, and when I was a teenager in the 70s, we had no migrants. And suddenly, in the 90s, from almost 0% of migrants, we jumped to 10, 11, 12%. So these migrants are very hardworking people, and they have contributed immensely to labor productivity rises and to wealth creation. The question is, what happens with that wealth and how is it distributed?
And as you're saying, it was distributed quite unequally.
Terribly so. We have been here at the University of Athens. We've been undertaking a study recently, in the last few months, on inequality and in particular on poverty rates. And it turns out that Greece has the second highest poverty proportion in the whole of Europe, the 27 European countries, And moreover, the social security system is failing to dampen that. And so what you have is a classic case of a contradiction whereby high growth and significant growth and wealth creation coexists, cohabits with the generation of poverty that we haven't had for many decades.
This sounds in many ways like the American economy. We're used to it here. Has it been a shock to the Greeks to see this kind of unequal development?
It has been, because in particular because the 1980s was a completely different era. It was an era that some of my economist colleagues think of as a period of stagnation in terms of GDP growth and so on, and it was not growing very fast. But in the period from 1981 to 1986, 87, there was a massive redistribution of income towards the poor. And that had created a set of expectations that the lower strata would catch up. And the narrative and the rhetoric of the elites in the 1990s fueled those expectations. The argument was a standard trickle-down effect. That is, you know, we will do things that will increase incomes at the top, and those will trickle down further. And so the 1980s are going to be thought of as a period of failure compared to the 1990s and this current decade, because not only are we going to have redistribution, but we're going to have a steady increases of the pie. Well, the pie did increase, but I would say that the living standards of the bottom 40% of the population have deteriorated.
I'm speaking with Yanis Varoufakis, who's a professor of economics at the University of Athens. And has the financial crisis and the gathering global recession affected Greece at all?
I don't believe that it has left anyone unaffected globally. Yes, of course. But it has struck directly onto what you might call in the United States the Main Street. The banking sector did not experience the trials and tribulations that your banking sector experienced. It went straight to diminutions in demand for manufacturing goods, for agricultural goods, for tourism, for all sorts of different services. So the impact of the global financial crisis in Greece was felt directly within the real economy.
And what about the current government? They were unpopular and scandal-ridden going into this. What was the story behind them? Who's running the show?
Well, it is the current government. It's the Conservative Party. The Conservative Party that was actually re-elected about a year and a half ago, only because of the incompetence of the Socialist Party and its leadership, if I may say so. It's not that the Conservatives did a good job in their first term from 2004 to last year. It's just that the official opposition did not manage to put forward a decent case for overthrowing what everybody considered to be an incompetent government. But now this incompetence has accelerated in the eyes of everyone well before these riots, and it has been compounded by major scandals, financial scandals, and a general air of decrepitude has surrounded this present government. I don't think they are in control at the moment, but at the same time, they are clinging on to power, because I don't think that any of their members of parliament are willing to incur the wrath of their party by bringing their government down. So it may last a bit longer.
I imagine the kids in the streets don't necessarily have a detailed political agenda, but are there any organized forces that are presenting an alternative as a result of this unrest?
Well, I'm afraid that this is the problem. The problem is that the kids on the streets are not part of an organized movement that can put forward demands in an articulate and convincing way, which means that these young kids they really don't have much hope. I think they are just saying we've had enough, and I don't think they entertain any prospects whatsoever of any government coming into power that would be to their liking, unlike other periods in modern Greek history, where the demonstrations and the marches had a very clear perspective regarding what they wanted done.
And are there any other forces in Greek society that could step into that vacuum?
I can't see them. I don't believe in vacuums. But I have to say that I can't see them for the time being. The socialist opposition is, I think, just as taken aback by what's going on as the government is. They may very well win the next election if it's called soon, but I don't think that they have a better idea than this government as to what is going on at the ground level. Perhaps they do, but I don't think they have any ideas as to what they can do about it. Because let's face it, in a global economy, especially within the European Union, there are very few degrees of freedom for an administration in Athens. We are now facing global problems that can only be dealt with in a large scale kind of way, and I don't think that a small country like Greece has the capacity to do what it takes to exit from this downward spiral.
So, if you were given absolute power, there's nothing you could imagine that Greece could do on its own.
Well, I dislike vacuums, and I'm an internal optimist. What I think the Greek government should do, it should go to Brussels and have a very serious discussion with our European partners, because the problems that Greece faces are problems that the whole of the European Union faces. I mean, in the United States, at least your Congress gets together and talks about fiscal stimulus programs and so on for the whole of the United States economy. Now, the European Union is a large economy, it's very well integrated within itself, and it needs that kind of federalist treatment. But unfortunately, the institutions of the European Union have not caught up with this reality. And I think that what a Greek government, a Portuguese government, a Spanish government, a French government should do is they should coalesce.
But the largest economy, the biggest power of all, Germany is objecting to any kind of stimulus program. Is this really threatening the future of the European Union?
Well, I'd say so. I would say so. It's not a question of the European Union being threatened, because, as I said, you know, France, Germany, Italy, and now Greece are well integrated. The question is whether Germany knows what its own interests are, because somebody needs to buy Mercedes-Benzes and BMWs and refrigerators, and unless there is a fiscal stimulus like the one that reportedly Obama is planning in your country, they won't be able to sell all these goodies. So I do believe that Germany needs to reacquire a sense of its own interests, and I think that even a small government like the Greek government could play a role in convincing them. It has happened before. This is not the very first time. In the early 1980s, a Greek government was instrumental in effectively changing the structure of the European Union by using its veto power regarding the accession of Spain and Portugal in order to create European-wide investment programs. I think it is possible for even for small governments to have some influence regarding the agenda of European politics, but that is the level at which these problems need to be addressed, at the level of Europe.
Finally, where do you see the situation going in the coming days and weeks?
I'm not a prophet, but I think that it's going to quieten down. There will be flare-ups in the future. I think that the government is going to become very risk-averse from now on. They're not going to be as ready to introduce reforms that will upset the demonstrators. There will be a period of limbo, and then there will be a general election. I think a honeymoon period may be in order for the new government in about a year's time from now, or a year's time from the next general election, we may have more riots.
And I know I said finally, but no, really finally. It looks to me like there's a whole neoliberal order that's lost credibility and lost the power really now to govern economies globally. They had a successful run of it for a couple of decades, but now it looks to have hit a wall. First of all, do you agree with that analysis? And second of all, do you see anything coherent that's waiting in the wings to take its place?
Well, I agree with your analysis entirely. The post-2008 world is going to be very different from what we've experienced the last 20 years or so. I think the main difference has to do with the way in which the flows of finance from all over the world to New York, financing your twin deficits. This is going to have to change. And it's going to have to change if the financial order is going to be reestablished. But the question for me regarding social stability has to do with the extent to which every the common man and woman who works for a wage is going to have some kind of say in the way in which the financial sector is being regulated.
And that was Yiannis Varoufakis, who teaches economics at the University of Athens. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. In honor of the young Greek writers, let's go out with this oldie from T-Rex. Apparently people thought Mark Bowen was some sort of communist when this came out back in 1972. Imagine that. Till next week, bye.
Good for my voice, but you